Right now, if you just look up, there are roughly 3,700 airplanes flying overhead. And, you know, they're equipped with engines that are so perfectly engineered and, like, so astonishingly fuel efficient that they are actually kind of breaking the global supply chain.
Yeah, breaking it completely. It's a massive issue.
Right. And we are looking at this multi-billion-dollar traffic jam, but it's not happening up in the sky. It's happening on the tarmac. It's happening in maintenance hangars all over the world. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring this really hidden, super high-stakes world of commercial aviation maintenance.
And it really is high stakes. I mean, we're looking at a huge logistical hurdle for the whole industry today.
Exactly. So our source material for this is this really in-depth industry report from Aviation Maintenance Magazine. It's called the Engines Capacity Crunch. And the core mission of our deep dive today is to basically unpack how the industry is fighting this crunch, you know, using infrastructure, human training, and even cutting-edge robotics.
Right, because this new generation of narrow body engines, like the ones strapped to the wings of the Airbus A320neo and the Boeing 737 and MAX families, they've completely revolutionized the economics of flying.
They really have. But, and this is the crazy part, their unprecedented success has actually created this very real, very pressing paradox.
Yeah, it's essentially the defining operational challenge of the decade for commercial aviation. Like, if you look at the report, the fundamental issue here isn't a design flaw. It's not that the engines are bad, it's a scaling problem.
Born entirely out of just overwhelming market demand, right?
Exactly. The airlines, they demanded these hyper-efficient engines because they had to offset super volatile fuel costs and, you know, meet much stricter emission standards. And the manufacturers, mostly GE Aerospace with their joint venture CFM International and then Pratt & Whitney, they delivered absolute marvels of modern thermodynamics.
But keeping those absolute marvels operating at that kind of scale, especially as they start to age out of their like initial deployment phase, it's just hitting the MRO sector, the maintenance, repair, and overhaul sector, hitting them with this huge wave of demand. And the legacy infrastructure just it simply wasn't built to absorb it.
No, not at all.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we can really understand how they're fixing the bottleneck, we have to establish the sheer mind-boggling scale of the hardware we're talking about here.
The numbers are pretty wild.
They are. Let's just look at the data in the report for GE Aerospace's CFM AP1A engines. So the article notes that customers pick these specific engines to power more than 60% of Airbus A320neo aircraft.
And for anyone listening who tracks the industry, that NEO just stands for new engine option. Basically, Airbus took their absolute workhorse narrow-body airframe and integrated these massive high-bypass turbofans onto it.
And capturing 60% market share on literally the most popular aircraft family in the world.
Right.
That is a staggering footprint.
It's total dominance. And the operational stats really reflect that density. The report outlines that there are over 3,700 LAP-powered aircraft in active service right now.
So constantly flying.
Constantly. They're being pushed really hard, operated by more than 150 different operators globally. So you have these engines flying in, you know, the really dry, abrasive heat of the Middle
Lots of
East.
sand and dust.
Right, exactly. And then also doing these high cycle, really short hop routes for European low cost carriers, or flying in the crazy high humidity environments of Southeast Asia. And across all those totally diverse operational profiles, the LAP engine fleet has already logged 60 million flight hours.
60 million. But, you know, the number that really highlights the incoming tidal wave for the whole MRO network, it isn't the 3,700 aircraft already in the air.
No, it's the order book.
Exactly, the order book. The report states they have this massive backlog of 10,000 engine orders still in hand. So the current fleet, which is already straining the global maintenance capacity, is just a fraction of what's coming down the assembly line.
Precisely. And the data just parallels almost perfectly when we look at their primary competitor, too, because Pratt and Whitney's GTF, the geared turbofan, is seeing equally aggressive demand. Like, the report shows they have more than 13,000 engine orders and commitments across over 90 customers worldwide.
13,000. And the near-term delivery schedule is just incredibly steep. The tech says over 1,500 of those Pratt & Whitney orders are slated for 2025 alone, and they currently have over 2,600 aircraft flying with the GTF right now.
Right, powering the A320neo family, the Airbus A220, the Embraer E2.
Yeah, and collectively, that specific fleet has logged 50 million flight hours. So 50 million for the GTF, 60 million for the LAP.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, when you aggregate those numbers, you start to understand the actual metallurgical reality of the situation.
The physical toll on the metal.
Exactly. The report points out that these engine programs are fundamentally shifting their life cycles. They are transitioning out of their initial entry into service phase and moving into what they call mature operational phases.
Okay, let me try an analogy here. Imagine you're the mayor of a city, right?
Yeah.
And you just mandated that everyone buy this highly complex, ultra-efficient electric sports car.
Okay, I like where this is going.
So everyone buys one, which is great. Great for the environment, super fast. But then a few years later, you suddenly realize there are only three mechanics in the whole city who actually know how to fix them. And all the cars are breaking down at the exact same time.
That's exactly what's happening. Let's drill down into what that mature phase actually means mechanically for these engines. Because an engine rolling off the final assembly line is pristine, right? It enters the sort of honeymoon phase. The required maintenance is largely preventative. It's light, routine inspections, fluid changes, maybe some really minor line maintenance adjustments.
Right, just kick in the tires, basically.
Basically. But when you hit tens of millions of flight hours across the fleet, you're dealing with the accumulation of extreme thermal cycling. These new engines, they run incredibly hot to achieve that crazy thermal efficiency. I mean, often hotter than the literal melting point of the metals inside them.
Wait, really? Hotter than the melting point?
Oh, yeah. They rely on these super sophisticated ceramic matrix composites and complex internal cooling channels just to keep from melting into a puddle. And over time, that just takes a massive toll.
Wow.
Turbine blades elongate, the thermal coatings degrade, you get microfractures starting to propagate, so that mature operational phase means they have to be taken completely off the wing, fully torn down, and overhauled.
And that is the exact crucible the MRO sector is facing right now. The industry refers to these as heavy shop visits, right?
Yeah, heavy shop visits. It's a total disassembly of the core modules. And the challenge isn't just that an engine needs to be overhauled. It's that thousands of these incredibly complex, incredibly hot-running engines are hitting their overhaul milestones simultaneously
because everyone bought them at the exact same time.
Right. So the capacity crunch is really just the realization that the existing global network of, tear down facilities, parts suppliers, and specialized labor pools, they just cannot process the sheer volume of metal entering the mature phase of its life cycle.
Which forces us to really look at the core bottleneck here. Because if a massive wave of engines needs heavy maintenance, why is it taking so long to turn them around? If you read between the lines of the report, the bottleneck isn't necessarily a lack of physical hangar floor space.
No, not at all.
It fundamentally comes down to the supply chain.
Yeah. And the report gives us a really stark, very direct assessment of this from Rob Griffiths.
Right. He's the Senior Vice President of Commercial Engines Operations at Pratt & Whitney.
Exactly. And his analysis just cuts right to the core of the issue. He states unequivocally that material constraints remain the primary driver of lead times.
Okay, let's be super clear about what material constraints actually means in this specific context. Because we aren't talking about, a shortage of standard aluminum or just basic wiring.
Oh, no, definitely not.
We're talking about the inability to source highly specific proprietary components fast enough. Like when an engine comes in for a heavy shop visit, it's torn down to its individual piece parts. And if an inspection reveals that a high-pressure turbine blade is out of tolerance, meaning it's just suffered too much thermal degradation or maybe some foreign object damage, it has to be replaced.
Right.
But if the global supply chain, which is already running at absolute maximum capacity just to build the 13,000 new engines on the order book, if they cannot divert a brand new blade to the MRO facility, that engine just sits there. Waiting.
It just sits there. It becomes this localized traffic jam that ripples outward. You have this asset worth literally tens of millions of dollars sitting totally idle on the shop floor because it's missing a component that weighs a few ounces.
That is wild.
And so the lead time, the duration from when the engine is inducted into the shop to when it's tested and returned to the airline, it stretches from a few days to weeks or even months.
Okay, but here's where it gets confusing. If we look at the internal data that Pratt & Whitney provided in the report regarding their performance transitioning from 2024 into 2025, there is this massive statistical anomaly.
Yeah, the numbers look a bit contradictory at first glance.
Right, because the report says they experienced a 40% year-over-year increase in heavy shop visits for more complex repairs.
Yeah.
A 40% spike in workload. And specifically for the absolute hardest, most resource-intensive types of teardowns.
Uh-huh.
Yet somehow, simultaneously, they managed to increase their overall MRO production by 26%. And then in the fourth quarter, that MRO production jumped by 39%, which they actually attribute to a 16% reduction in lead times.
Yeah, it really does seem impossible on the surface. Like, how do you process 40% more complex teardowns while simultaneously reducing the time it takes to process them by 16%?
It's exactly.
All while dealing with a totally choked global supply chain for new parts.
Yeah, so if I'm understanding this correctly, they are getting slammed with way more complex repairs, but they are actually getting faster at turning them around. How much of this is just, you know, running the current system hotter, making people work overtime versus actually fundamentally changing how they work?
It's a fundamental change because you can't outwork a material constraint. If the titanium forging literally isn't in the building, the engine doesn't get built, no matter how much overtime you pay. So they had to fundamentally circumvent the supply chain altogether.
And how'd they do that?
Well, Rob Griffiths provides the operational shift that made this possible. He attributes those reduced lead times to a, quote, significant increase in component repair volumes. And this is the critical pivot in modern MRO strategy right now.
Okay, component repair.
Yeah. It's the shift from a replace philosophy to a repair philosophy.
Right, let's dissect the engineering behind that. Because historically, right, in older, simpler engines, if a part was worn out, the most economically viable and fastest route was often just to scrap it and pull a brand new part from the inventory shelf.
Yep, just toss it and grab a new one.
But when a single turbine blade in a geared turbofan is this intricate, wildly expensive piece of single crystal superalloy with, like, microscopic internal cooling labyrinths, scrapping it is incredibly wasteful, and waiting for a new one from the foundry just takes way too long.
Exactly. So instead of throwing it away, the MRO facilities have invested heavily, and I mean heavily, in the metallurgical capability to restore that specific worn component back to its original factory specifications.
Oh, wow.
We are talking about highly advanced procedures here. If a blade tip is worn down because of friction against the outer seal, they aren't just filing it smooth. They are using automated electron beam welding in literal vacuum chambers to build the blade tip back up, molecule by molecule.
Molecule by molecule.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're using high-velocity oxygen fuel spraying to reapply those thermal barrier coatings we talked about.
Okay, but wait. If you are doing localized welding and recoating on a turbine blade, instead of just installing a factory fresh part, how does the industry ensure structural integrity? I mean, we're talking about components spinning at, what, 15,000 RPM in an environment that is thousands of degrees?
Right.
Doesn't repairing a stressed component inherently compromise its lifespan compared to a brand new forging?
That is the exact concern that the regulatory bodies like the FAA and EASA monitor so rigorously. But the key thing to understand is that component repair in aerospace is not just a quick patch job.
It's not duct tape and super glue.
Definitely not. It is a full remanufacturing process, and it's subject to non-destructive testing that is just as stringent as the original manufacturing. Once a blade is welded and remachined, it undergoes digital radiography, ultrasonic inspection, fluorescent penetrant inspection, all to guarantee there are zero subsurface voids or microcracks. If it passes all of that, it is metallurgically and dimensionally identical to a brand new part.
Wow. Okay, so by doing this locally right there in the shop, Pratt & Whitney completely bypassed the need to wait for the constrained global supply chain to ship them a new part.
Exactly. They just utilized the raw material they already had sitting on the teardown bench.
And that completely explains the 16% reduction in lead time. You aren't waiting for a cargo ship. You are literally controlling the timeline internally.
You're making the part you need out of the part you have.
That's brilliant. But Griffiths also mentions another strategy in the report to combat the volume of engines coming in. He discusses integrating durability upgrades into the GTF engine to increase in-flight uptime.
Yeah, this is a much more proactive measure rather than a reactive one. They are leveraging all the massive amounts of data from those 50 million flight hours. When they tear down hundreds of engines, they can identify the specific components that consistently degrade faster than their predictive models anticipated.
Like finding the weak links.
Right. Maybe a specific stator vane is eroding prematurely because of particulate ingestion in certain environments. Instead of simply repairing it to the original design or replacing it with the exact same vulnerable part, the engineering teams back at headquarters actually design an upgrade.
Oh, interesting.
They might change the alloy composition or adjust the aerodynamic profile or alter the cooling hole geometry to just make it more resilient.
So when the engine comes into the MRO facility for its scheduled heavy shop visit, it gets retrofitted with these newer, tougher components. It's essentially this evolutionary cycle. The engine that leaves the shop is mechanically superior to the engine that entered it.
Precisely. And the economic imperative here is maximizing what they call time on wing.
Time on wing.
Yeah. If a durability upgrade extends the operational life of a high-pressure compressor by an extra 2,000 flight cycles, you have successfully delayed that engine's next required shop visit.
Right. You're actively dampening future demand on the whole MRO network by just making the existing fleet more robust.
Exactly. It's a huge pressure relief valve for the industry.
Okay. But optimizing component repair and upgrading parts, that really only solves part of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are heavily reliant on repairing components, the actual physical location of that repair work becomes the next massive logistical hurdle.
Geography becomes everything.
Right, because you can't have one centralized superfactory in, like Ohio or Connecticut, repairing every single turbine blade for the entire global fleet.
Yeah.
The turnaround time would be completely destroyed by the sheer physics of transoceanic freight.
Oh, absolutely. The logistics of heavy aviation freight are punishing. Shipping a multi-ton engine core across the world requires specialized cargo aircraft, complex customs clearances, and just immense shipping costs. So if your goal is to reduce lead times, you have to completely decentralize the operation. You literally have to bring the heavy maintenance capabilities directly to the regional epicenters where the aircraft actually operate.
Which moves us into the massive multi-billion-dollar geographical restructuring that's detailed in the report.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, reading this section, it looks like a giant high-stakes game of risk.
It really does.
You have these companies strategically placing these fortresses of maintenance to capture regional markets before the big end-of-decade surge hits. Let's look at the Asia-Pacific region first, because the scale of investment there is just unprecedented. The report highlights a $300 million investment by GE Aerospace in Singapore, designed to be fully operational by 2029.
And Singapore makes perfect sense. It's the logistical anchor for the entire Asia-Pacific aviation market. It sits right at the crossroads of massive high-growth airline networks. So GE Aerospace's $300 million initiative, which, by the way, is supported by the Singapore Economic Development Board, it isn't just about adding extra hangar floor space.
Right, it's a capability upgrade.
Yes. They are establishing an AI center of excellence to develop automated inspection solutions, which we'll touch on a bit later. And they are building a dedicated facility for REACH-compliant coatings.
Right. And for those unfamiliar, REACH is an incredibly stringent European Union regulation. It concerns the registration, evaluation, and restriction of chemicals.
Super strict.
So by building a REACH-compliant facility in Singapore, GE is ensuring that their chemical stripping and recoating processes meet the absolute highest global environmental and safety standards, meaning an engine repaired in Singapore can be seamlessly reintegrated into a European fleet without any compliance friction.
Exactly. It creates a completely frictionless global standard. But you know, what's fascinating here is the most operationally significant aspect of this Singapore expansion, and it comes from the insights of Ian Roger.
He's the managing director of GE Aerospace Component Repair in Singapore, right?
That's the one. He outlines the specific function of their new Building 8 at the Seletar Aerospace Campus. And he states that they are moving from individual engine component repair to engine module repair on LEP-1A and 1B high-pressure turbine modules.
Okay, so that phrasing, moving from component repair to module repair,
mm-hmm.
It kind of sounds like a subtle semantic difference. But operationally, it fundamentally rewrites the downtime equation for an airline.
Completely rewrites it.
Let's map this out for the listener. Because a jet engine isn't just one big single tube of parts, right? It's modular. Yeah. It's built in these distinct interchangeable sections. You have the fan, the low-pressure compressor, the high-pressure compressor, the combustor, and the high-pressure turbine, the HPT. And Ian Roger is focused specifically on that HPT module.
Right, and the HPT module is arguably the most critical and heavily stressed section of the entire engine. It extracts the energy from the superheated exhaust gases immediately exiting the combustion chamber to drive the compressor.
So it's taking the absolute brunt of the heat.
Oh, yeah. It experiences the highest temperatures and the most aggressive thermal degradation. Consequently, it is very often the specific module that dictates the frequency of these heavy shop visits.
Okay, so under the traditional component repair model we talked about earlier, if an airline in, say, Jakarta has a LEP engine that triggers an HPT fault, they have to drop the entire engine off the wing. They might have to ship the whole engine or at least spend time tearing down the HPT section, extract the damaged blades or nozzles, and send those specific widgets off to a specialized repair shop.
And wait.
Exactly, they wait. While those parts are being welded and coated somewhere else, the airline's $100 million aircraft is just sitting on the tarmac, generating zero revenue.
And the daily financial penalty for a grounded narrow-body aircraft is immense. We're talking huge losses. So what I and Roger and the Building A team in Singapore are enabling is a modular swap system. Because they can now repair and assemble entire HPT modules locally, they can maintain a pool of ready-to-go, fully refurbished modules right there in the region.
Okay, that is super cool. It's conceptually similar to, like, replacing a server blade in a massive data center. You don't bring a soldering iron onto the server floor to fix a burned-out capacitor on a motherboard.
No, that would take forever.
Right. You just slide the dead server rack out, slide a fully functional one in, and reboot the system. Then you take the broken rack back to the lab to diagnose and solder it on your own time.
That is the exact logistical philosophy they are applying here. The airline in Jakarta removes the degraded HRET module from their engine, instantly slots in a fully refurbished HPT module supplied directly from that regional pool in Singapore, and the aircraft is back in the revenue schedule in a matter of days rather than months.
Incredible.
Yeah. And then the degraded module is shipped the relatively short distance to Seletar, where Ian Rogers' team breaks it down, repairs the individual components, rebuilds the module, tests it, and places it right back into the regional supply pool for the next customer.
Wow. And as Roger points out in the report, this creates incredibly tight connectivity within their overhaul supply chains, specifically for Asia and the Middle East. You eliminate that trans-Pacific shipping lag entirely.
Exactly.
But Singapore isn't an isolated case here. The report takes us on this rapid-fire tour of similar capacity expansions globally. Like, if you look at the Americas, MTU Maintenance Fort Worth in Texas is undergoing a massive transition.
Oh, yeah. Huge upgrade.
They're upgrading from what was essentially just an on-site service center,
yeah,
you know, handling minor repairs and borescope inspections, into a comprehensive facility with full disassembly, assembly, and testing capabilities for both the LEP and the older GenX engines.
Right. They are aggressively capturing that massive North American domestic fleet. And you also see Pratt & Whitney completing a $70 million, 81,000 square foot expansion at their Columbus Engine Center in Georgia, which aggressively increases their annual capacity by 25%.
And they aren't just building their own facilities either. They're deeply integrating with airline-owned MROs.
Yeah, like Delta TechOps.
Exactly. Pratt & Whitney expanded their agreement with Delta TechOps to secure a 30% increase in annual overhaul capacity specifically for the PW1500G engine that powers the A220. And pushing into South America, MTU Maintenance du Brasil relocated to a significantly larger facility in Tampoa.
So the Western Hemisphere is really locking down its regional repair networks. But the density of MRO expansion in Europe is equally aggressive, particularly in Eastern Europe, which has quickly become a massive hub for precision aerospace manufacturing and repair.
Right. The European footprint is expanding rapidly just to service the dense, high-frequency, low-cost carrier networks operating there, like Ryanair and EasyJet pushing those planes to the limit.
Exactly. In Poland, GE Aerospace, in a joint venture with Lufthansa Technik, inaugurated Exios. It is a staggering 35,000 square meter facility near Wrocław.
A facility of that size isn't just a repair shop. That is an industrial complex.
Truly. And staying in Poland, EME Aero, which is another joint venture between MTU and Lufthansa Technik, but focused specifically on the Pratt & Whitney GTF, they just celebrated delivering their 1,000th overhauled engine.
Amazing.
But they aren't stopping there. The report notes they announced a $37 million expansion to push their throughput to over 500 engines annually starting in 2028.
And you also see expansion in Germany, with MTU Maintenance Berlin-Brandenburg expanding their PW800 program to comprehensive MRO service. Plus, their Ludwigsfelde location is building a new facility to increase workshop volume by 30%.
And finally, the Middle East is securing localized capability for the new generation engines too. Pratt & Whitney announced the addition of Sanad to the GTF network, which is a really critical milestone because it represents the very first GTF workshop in the South Asia, Middle East, and North Africa region. They're scheduling their first engine induction for 2028.
Oh, and ITP joined as the 21st GTF workshop globally as well.
Yep. And if we round out the global map back in the Asia Pacific, alongside GE's move in Singapore, MTU Maintenance Zhuhai in China opened a second production facility in Jinwan. Once that's fully spooled up, those two sites combined will have an annual capacity of over 700 maintenance interventions.
Wow.
And Pratt and Whitney also signed an agreement in Singapore specifically to add repair capacity for the GTF's fan drive gear system.
Okay, so if you step back and plot all of these expansions on a map, you know, Texas, Georgia, Sao Paulo, Roll Claw, Berlin, the Middle East, Zhuhai, Singapore, it really is a flawless execution of decentralized logistics.
It's totally necessary, yeah.
But, and this is a big but, this massive pouring of concrete and installation of testing cells introduces the next and arguably most difficult bottleneck. Because you can build a 35,000 square meter hangar in Poland, and you can fill it with all the electron beam welders and ultrasonic testing tanks you want. But facilities don't fix engines.
People do.
People fix engines. You require a hyper-specialized human workforce to operate that machinery. And, you know, whenever we hear about massive industrial expansion, the next phrase is usually labor shortage. And the aerospace sector is facing a severe demographic cliff regarding experienced maintenance technicians.
The human element really is the friction point where capital investment meets demographic reality. The older generation of mechanics, the folks who possess decades of tribal knowledge on legacy engines, they are retiring.
Right.
And the new generation of LAP and GTF engines require a fundamentally different baseline of knowledge. You're dealing with advanced composites, complex geared architectures, intricate digital sensor networks. You cannot simply post a job listing on the internet and expect to hire hundreds of fully certified, highly experienced MRO technicians off the open market.
But the talent pool is incredibly shallow.
Exactly.
Which means the MRO providers can't just be repair companies anymore. They basically have to become educational institutions. So they have to manufacture the talent pipeline alongside the physical infrastructure.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're doing.
The report actually provides a fascinating case study on how they are navigating this. It focuses on GE Aerospace's Selma facility located in Três Rios, Brazil.
Right. The Selma facility illustrates the scale of the labor challenge perfectly. The report details that this specific location is aggressively expanding its capacity. They are moving from an output of 600 engines a year to 1,000 engines a year.
So an almost doubling of throughput.
Exactly. And to achieve that throughput, they need to add 400 new technical jobs, which brings their total workforce footprint in the Rio state to nearly 4,000 employees.
That's massive.
It is. But to acquire 400 highly specialized technicians in a single region, GE Aerospace relies heavily on deep structural partnerships with technical education institutions. At Selma, the core pipeline is a partnership with SENAI.
Right, SENAI, which stands for Servicio Nacional de Aprendizagem Industrial. It's a massive, nationally recognized vocational training network in Brazil. It was established by industrial companies specifically to cultivate technical talent for the manufacturing sector.
And Julio Talon, who serves as GE Aerospace's MRO leader for Brazil, provides a very clear rationale for why this partnership is basically the lifeblood of their expansion. He notes that GE Aerospace has historically hired a very high percentage of SENAI graduates.
Makes sense.
But the critical value SENAI provides isn't necessarily that they produce a student who knows exactly how to tear down a LEAP engine on day one.
Right.
It is that they provide the students with a rigorous, unshakable foundation in the underlying physical sciences of aerospace technology.
Okay, but let's push on that timeline a little bit.
Yeah.
Because if we are looking at a 40% year-over-year jump in heavy shop visits right now, and a backlog of 10,000 LEAP engines preparing to enter service. The industry doesn't really have a decade to wait for a 19-year-old student to slowly mature into a master technician, right?
No, they don't.
So it sounds like Selma is circumventing this by basically getting involved at the high school or trade school level. But is human training fast enough to keep up with that 40% jump in heavy shop visits we talked about earlier? Can you really take a graduate from a technical academy, even a rigorous one like SENAI, and just put them on a shop floor working on a multi-million dollar high-pressure turbine?
Well, you don't put them on the high-pressure turbine on day one. It is a highly structured, tiered apprenticeship model.
Ah, okay.
As Julio Talon explains it, the SENAI graduates arrive with the foundational literacy. So they understand aerodynamics, they understand basic metallurgy, they understand how to read complex technical manuals, and they comprehend the rigorous safety culture required in aerospace.
Which is half the battle, really.
Exactly. Once they are inside the Selma facility, GE takes over the specialized training. They offer these foundational graduates the opportunities to develop the highly advanced, very specific skills required for LAPD engine maintenance as they gain hands-on, heavily supervised experience.
So they start them on the less critical modules. They might start in, like, the disassembly bays, learning how to safely extract wiring harnesses and outer casings, all under the direct supervision of a senior technician.
Yep, exactly.
And then over years, as they prove their competency and absorb all those proprietary methodologies, they migrate inward toward the more complex, higher stress core modules.
Precisely. It's an internal cultivation of talent. Talon points to LA engine maintenance specifically as a career growth opportunity. By bringing them in with a solid foundation and providing a clear, technologically advanced pathway for skill acquisition, they secure long-term employee retention.
Which is vital when you're investing years into training them. You don't want them leaving for a competitor.
Exactly.
It's a brilliant localized strategy for Selma. But, you know, if we pull the lens back to the global capacity crunch, we have to acknowledge a harsh mathematical reality. The human training pipeline, no matter how optimized, is fundamentally linear. It takes years to forge a master technician. But the demand curve, driven by those 13,000 GTF orders and 10,000 LEAPE orders, is exponential. Human training, on its own, cannot scale fast enough to meet a sudden 40% surge in complex teardowns.
And the industry is acutely aware of that limitation. When human capital cannot scale linearly with demand, the only operational lever left to pull is technological leverage.
You have to dramatically increase the productivity of the master technicians you already have.
Right. Which brings us to the integration of robotics into the MRO hangar.
Yes. The rise of the machines. But the way the report details this transition is very different from, like, the standard narrative of industrial automation we usually hear about.
Yeah, it's not the sci-fi movie scenario.
Right. This isn't a scenario where an airline buys a massive robot, turns the lights off in the factory, and fires all the mechanics.
Well, the lights-out manufacturing concept just doesn't apply to the incredibly nuanced, highly variable world of engine overhaul. Every worn engine that comes into the shop is degraded in its own unique way.
Because they've flown in different environments, right?
Exactly. You are dealing with microscopic variations, seized bolts, unpredictable thermal warping. A fully autonomous robotic system cannot navigate that level of physical ambiguity on its own.
So the automation has to be targeted. Let's look at how Rob Griffiths from Pratt & Whitney frames their investment in this space.
Huh.
He explicitly outlines the operational goals of their robotic integration. He says it is designed to improve safety, reduce the risk of ergonomic injury to the technicians, achieve greater repeatability in highly sensitive tasks, reduce the amount of rework caused by human error, and ultimately cut down process times and material waste.
And to understand how this works in practice, the report gives us a really fascinating spotlight on a specific robotic system deployed at Pratt & Whitney's Eagle Services Asia, or ESA MRO facility in Singapore.
Yes.
The system is affectionately named Alfred.
Alfred. What exactly is Alfred's mandate on the shop floor?
Alfred is assigned to one of the most mechanically demanding and frankly tedious procedures in the entire facility. It handles the assembly of the rotors for the GTF engine's high pressure compressor.
Okay, let's unpack why rotor assembly is so difficult. Because we are talking about stacking a series of heavily bladed discs together perfectly along a central axis, right?
Right.
And because these rotors spin at tens of thousands of revolutions per minute, the balance has to be absolute. If the center of mass is off by even a fraction of a millimeter, the resulting vibration will literally tear the engine apart from the inside. The tolerances, the acceptable margin of error for alignment, are measured in microns.
Exactly. So when a human technician stacks those rotors, it requires immense physical dexterity, intense concentration, and constant micromeasurements. It is incredibly repetitive, high-stakes work.
And human hands get fatigued.
They do. A technician's attention might waver slightly in the seventh hour of a shift. And the accumulation of tiny alignment errors, what engineers call run out, can force the team to unstack the entire rotor and start over, which is a massive waste of labor hours.
But Alfred, as an automated robotic arm, doesn't get tired. It maintains those micron-level tolerances perfectly, layer after layer, flawlessly repeating the exact spatial movements required.
Exactly. And critically, as it stacks the rotor, it simultaneously records and analyzes key process quality data, creating this perfect digital verification of the assembly.
The return on investment for delegating that specific task to a machine is just staggering. The report states that Alfred has allowed the ESA facility in Singapore to have the process times for rotor assembly, have it. But more importantly, it reduced the required man hours for that specific task by 85%.
And, you know, this raises an important question, because when you introduce a metric like an 85% reduction in man hours, it inevitably triggers the debate around job displacement.
Right. Does bringing Alfred online mean 85% of the rotor assembly team is redundant?
In a standard manufacturing environment, maybe. But in the MRO sector, where they are desperately short of skilled labor, it's the exact opposite. If we look at the operational reality detailed by Griffiths, this is purely an exercise in workforce reallocation.
Reallocation, not reduction.
Exactly. Because Alfred is handling the repetitive, physically taxing rotor stacking, three human operators are completely freed up from that station.
And they are reallocated to perform much more complex, high-value tasks that a robot simply cannot execute.
Right. For instance, the final dynamic balancing of the assembled rotor. Balancing requires a technician to interpret complex vibration data, apply intuitive mechanical judgment, and make micro-adjustments to the weighting of the disc.
It's an art form.
It really is. It requires an experiential understanding of physics that an automated stacking arm simply does not possess.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It's like a master chef having an automated machine to chop onions perfectly every time. The machine isn't the chef. It just frees up the chef to actually create the sauce.
That is the perfect operational analogy. The machine elevates the human's capability. And the report highlights another example of this collaborative automation at the exact same ESA facility in Singapore. They utilize what they classify as a cobot.
A collaborative robot.
Right, designed to work seamlessly alongside human technicians.
And what is the cobot's specific function?
Its function is entirely documentation. The cobot is equipped with highly sensitive optical sensors. Its job is to systematically photograph the external engine components to document their exact physical condition before the overhaul begins, and then photograph them all again after the overhaul is complete.
Oh man, let's consider how tedious that is for a human. We are talking about an engine with thousands of exterior connection points, wiring harnesses, and fluid lines. And the regulatory bodies demand absolute visual proof of the engine's state for compliance and safety auditing.
It's mandatory.
So asking a master technician, someone who spent years at an academy like Senai learning advanced metallurgy, to walk around a cold engine block taking 500 specific photographs with a digital camera, that is a massive misallocation of their specialized skills.
It is the definition of a mundane routine. By delegating that visual mapping to the cobot, the ESA facility reduced the man hours spent on photographic documentation by 90%.
90%.
That is a massive block of time returned to the workforce. The technicians spend their shifts actually diagnosing and turning wrenches, while the cobot ensures absolute process integrity.
The robot never forgets to photograph a specific valve, the lighting is always perfectly calibrated, and the digital record is flawlessly integrated into the engine's maintenance file.
Yep. And Rob Griffiths notes that this level of MRO automation is not an isolated experiment. It is industry-leading, and Pratt & Whitney is actively evaluating rolling out these robotic innovations to other shops across the global GTF network.
Because it's the only mathematically viable way to scale their output, they must combine all three operational vectors. They need the geographical footprint to eliminate shipping delays, they need the human pipeline to perform the complex analytical repairs, and they need the robotic leverage to accelerate the repetitive processes.
It's a three-pronged attack.
So as we synthesize the layers of this deep dive, the scale of the engine's capacity crunch truly comes into focus. We started with the paradox of success. These incredibly efficient, wildly popular narrowbody engines that are inadvertently choking the global supply chain, simply because they are entering their mature operational life cycles simultaneously in massive numbers.
Right, driven fundamentally by constrained material supply chains for highly specialized superalloys, which then forces the pivot from replacing parts to repairing them at a molecular level.
And to execute that repair philosophy and keep the global fleet flying safely and on time, the industry is executing this synchronized multi-billion-dollar strategy. First, aggressive geographic expansion. They are decentralizing heavy maintenance, putting shops where the planes are, building massive fortresses in Poland, Brazil, and Texas, and transitioning to module-level repair hubs like Ian Rogers Building 8 in Singapore so airlines can swap entire turbine sections locally instead of shipping engines across oceans.
Second, the systematic cultivation of human capital. partnering with technical academies like SENAI to ensure a continuous pipeline of technicians who possess the foundational physics knowledge required to master these complex architectures.
And finally, the strategic deployment of targeted automation. Integrating collaborative robots and automated assembly arms like Alfred to handle the high-tolerance, highly repetitive tasks, freeing up the master technicians to focus on the intricate, judgment-heavy repairs. It is an astonishing orchestration of logistics, engineering, and human training.
It absolutely is. And you know, as we conclude, I want to leave you with one final thought regarding the long-term trajectory of this industry.
Lay it on me.
We discussed the implementation of durability upgrades earlier, proactively re-engineering components to extend the time an engine can remain on the wing before requiring a shop visit.
Right, making them tougher.
Well, as material science continues to advance, and as these engines become increasingly sophisticated digital entities constantly streaming real-time performance data, thermal profiles, and vibration analytics back to the manufacturers, we are approaching the era of true predictive maintenance.
The concept of the digital twin, where they know exactly how the engine is degrading in real time.
Exactly. If the AI diagnostics can predict a component failure months before it happens, and if the durability upgrades make core failures exceedingly rare, the fundamental nature of the MRO facility will inevitably shift.
How so?
Well, will the maintenance hub of the future look less like a heavy industrial teardown bay filled with cranes and welding chambers, and more like a sterile, highly automated data center? A place where physical wrench-turning overhauls are the rare exception, and surgical, digitally guided module swaps are the norm.
Wow.
It is a fascinating technological horizon to think about.
It is an incredible evolution to consider. The next time you are sitting on the tarmac, listening to the hum of a highly efficient narrow-body engine spooling up on the wing, take a moment to appreciate the invisible, global, multi-billion-dollar synchronized dance of technicians, robots, and logistics, making sure that engine performs flawlessly. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the fascinating hidden architecture of aviation maintenance. Keep your curiosity alive, keep asking the hard questions, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.